Hey, welcome to the Freethink.
This is how we start the podcast.
This is Hard Reset, a series about rebuilding our world from scratch.
I'm used to doing voiceover in my garage at night, so like, this is weird. Hi, welcome to the Hard Reset podcast. I'm Nick Tucker.
And I'm Taylor Hamilton.
We are the co-creators of the show Hard Reset, which is on Freethink, and it's a show about how you would rebuild the world from scratch and what are the technologies and people and ideas that would make that possible. Joining us is Rob Chapman-Smith.
Hi, I'm the editor-in-chief of Freethink.
And Toby Morishanu.
Hey, I'm the person who reads and responds to all of your comments, for better or for worse.
Mostly better? Mostly worse.
50-50.
All right.
How much is this going to cost?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. How often do people just want to know what this is going to cost?
How much is this going to cost?
A lot.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking a little bit more in depth about each of these episodes, dive into the technology and the ideas and the people behind them, talk about the things we didn't get a chance to talk about, respond to some of your comments, and also going to, at the end of the episode, dive into your meanest comments, which I'm really looking forward to. So look forward to sharing this with you. Please make sure you like and subscribe so that we can continue to spam you with more content. Nailed it. So this is the first episode of the podcast, so we're going to talk about the first episode of the show. The first episode of the show was about vertical farming. We featured a company called Plenty. And vertical farming, if you're not familiar, is the idea of growing things on a vertical surface instead of a horizontal surface. And what's nice is you can do this indoors. You can do this in large warehouse spaces, and you can light it artificially. So that was the first episode we did. Please check it out. Make sure you watch it. It was a lot of fun, and I think it's one of our most successful episodes, too. And there's been a lot of interest in vertical farming. But I'm curious, as we went through this, like for you, Taylor, what was the big deal about this? What was the thing that was most interesting to you about vertical farming?
I think what's really interesting about this is that it's just one of these things that to me is like so clear that this is the future. There's so much money being pumped into it in general, which I think is finally going to help it tip in terms of adoption. But I think at the end of the day, people want good tasting food.
Right.
Like I spend a lot of time in Tennessee and you have a salad out in Tennessee and you're like, the salad sucks. Mm. And you come over to California where we're like, we have such great access to all the fruits and vegetables and it's a totally different thing. And I think because people index so much on taste and because you're able to grow this stuff really locally, I think that's really what's actually going to change things more than technology getting cheaper or there becoming a lot more money into it.
Right. Yeah, I think I tend to take that for granted because I grew up working in a grocery store where we had daily fresh deliveries of produce every day. And in living in California, like you just sort of take that for granted. But yeah, when you actually get out of California, it is amazing how, not everywhere, but in a lot of places, it's really hard to find that great fresh produce.
Yeah, and I think about colonization sometimes, and
I can't imagine why.
And it's like people would set across the world on ships when the world was possibly flat and go because they wanted some like better spice or salt and pepper in their food, right? And so like we as a species are very much driven by our taste buds, and I don't think that that is going to change much.
Right.
And you know, one of the points that we bring up towards the end of the episode is about how you could have the same kinds of fruits and vegetables being grown in somewhere really, really hot, like the UAE, or somewhere really, really cold, right? And I think that being able to get the same stuff locally, it's just going to change so much of people's diets because to date, it's been very much controlled by like, what can you grow close to you,
right?
Or what can you afford to ship close to you?
Right. So the question that we would often ask ourselves when we were developing the show was, is this really a hard reset? And I'm curious, what's your impression of that then versus now? Has your thoughts changed? You know, in your mind, is vertical farming really a hard reset?
Yeah. I mean, I think for the average consumer, I don't think that they'll notice this like massive shift happen day to night.
Right.
Day to night. As you know, I think what is going to happen is you're going to have, you know, companies like Plenty that all of a sudden you're in your grocery store and you're like, oh, I haven't heard of that brand. What is that? Oh, let me try that. Oh, that tastes a little bit better. Like, I dig that. So I think for the consumer side, that adoption is going to be a little bit slower. But I think the hard reset really is around our mentality around what we think of as a farm.
Right.
Right. And one of the things that I think of as Americans of like what our ideals are, you can always tell when you go into like the internet, you fly back and you're in the international terminal and you're going through customs and they have these like big screens up, like promoting like American, you know, values. And it's like someone on like horseback and someone like picking, you know, like some wheat, so, you know, like we have this notion about.
Can you do the motion of picking wheat again?
I don't know. Is that how you do it? I've never done it. I don't live close to a farm.
You never just picked some weed and chomped down?
Maybe like that, right? It's like a little chop.
Yeah, it's cool.
A little chop.
Yeah, I think okay. It's like a scythe, whatever they use.
Yeah, I'm from LA. Yeah. You know, we don't have wheat in our backyards. So I think that we, even though I think it was at less than 1% of Americans are farmers.
Yeah,
we still very much like. Really fixate on the idea of farming,
right?
That's like something that's really important to us from like a value standpoint. And yet, you know, there's all sorts of things that we do in order to not necessarily promote farming in quite the right ways.
Right.
And I think one of the conceits of the show that we were trying to at least do was say, we're going to totally ignore the politics around all this. Right, we're gonna just like forget the implementation, forget the government, forget any of that stuff, and let's just talk about the idea.
Right.
But I think for the purposes of this conversation, the question is like what are the barriers that we're going to have towards it? I'm curious what you think.
There's so many different issues that depend on the different localities in which you're going to build something like this. So I think of something like zoning laws, right? And it might be really hard to do this in a place like California, where it's harder to build than maybe other places in the country where there's like easier zoning laws around this type of thing. Or I think about just general industries that might view this as a threat. So where are the lobbying interests going to be like, I don't want this type of thing in my backyard. And they're just going to be against that in some type of way. But I think the biggest thing that's probably going to be the barrier to this is that, and then you sort of hit at this, I don't know if people are going to want to let go of the way that they're currently producing food enough to have this be at scale. Versus like somebody just coming in and winning the economic argument where it's like, it's more efficient for us to do this. We're going to be able to produce more food this way. And just the business aspect just wins the day. I don't know which one of those sorts of things is the stronger driver of the activity of us making food right now.
Right. There's something cool about going to a farmer's market and you're meeting the farmer.
Right.
Getting that and they're able to tell you exactly how they planted it and where it came from. Like that connection feels really good. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think at the end of the day, traditional farming never goes away completely. Right.
Yeah.
It just becomes a facet of this larger thing. And I agree with you. Like, I think that the zoning is a big deal. I mean, we're in Los Angeles right now where there is a drought and water restrictions mm-hmm. that are happening. And yet and still, we just decided to not have a desalination plant come in Long Beach, right? So it's like we're literally running out of water. And the thing that could give us more water, we said no to because nobody wanted it in their backyard.
Right? I don't want that.
Yeah.
I don't want that, right?
Well, to be fair, 80% of our water here goes to agriculture, and this is 99% efficient water-wise.
So yo, Toby did the stat research, man. Like, yo, I was waiting for that stat.
Someone say numbers? So, I mean, it is kind of cool. I mean, the two that have opened, right? There's one in Compton, and there's one in Northern California. And it would be really cool to see if that could be a part of the strategy. But obviously, agricultural politics are super, super big in California.
Yeah.
So there's that as well. But one thing I'm curious about, because you've eaten it.
Yeah.
And you've seen it in the market as well. Are they marketing it as, in the store, like, this is a revolutionary next generation? Or are they just saying, this looks good and it tastes good?
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember when they started selling commercially grown hydroponic tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And it was like hydroponic hothouse tomatoes. That was all over that. They were definitely selling it as hydroponic tomatoes. And mm-hmm. I didn't get that impression from this. So I went and I bought it at Whole Foods and to try it out for the show. And I actually still get it every once in a while because mm-hmm. it is pretty damn good. Can I say that? Yeah, I can say that. It's the internet. but it's pretty good. And they don't really market it as that. I think it says some copy on the front of the packaging as locally, vertically owned or something like that. But it's not the major thing that they're going for. They really, really do seem to be marketing it as a more flavorful green that you can buy, which I think is interesting. And if you're just trying to compete on quality alone, and not bring in or lean heavily on the sustainability or technology side of things, I think that's kind of an interesting choice.
Do you think the sustainability aspect of this is enough of a marketing hook for people to want to make that decision?
I think sustainability as a marketing thing really only works when you are already close to price parity. So if I'm looking at the package of spinach that is grown traditionally and the vertically farmed one, and that's the only differentiator, I'm just going to go for the cheaper one, unless I'm like, oh, well, this is probably a little better for the planet, so I'll spend the extra, you know, 10% for that.
Part of me wonders also, though, about, like, you know, food, who is a food purchaser is an interesting question. And one of the biggest food purchasers that we have is the government. And they actually have a responsibility, in some sense, to lower the carbon footprint. They do this through a bunch of regulations, but they can also do it through their purchasing power. And part of me wonders, is there an argument for, like, when the government is providing food resources to people through the variety of ways that it does, is it incumbent on them to use this technology in order to reduce the carbon footprint of agriculture in the United States? Like, what would it take for them to do that?
Right.
I'm just really glad that corn can't be vertically produced right now, because I feel like corn is like the third rail when it comes to a topic that, you know? So, but I agree. I mean, there is the idea of something being direct to consumer, but nothing is really direct to consumer, right? It's getting bought by, like, Safeway or Albertsons, which owns, I think, 21 different grocery store brands. And then so they are the buyer. And then there's all the different restaurants, and but they're buying their stuff from like conglomerates as well. So I think the question will be, is it cheaper? And are consumers like starting to taste the difference and starting to demand that?
Yeah,
I think what you were saying about like taste dominating everything is totally right. Like if you say this tastes better and it's a little cheaper, you don't have to have another sales pitch, you know? Yeah. That's enough for people. And a lot of the times you're eating vegetables, they're not the ones that you purchased yourself. They're from a grocery store, or they're from a restaurant, or they're from a cafeteria or something like that, or an ingredient in something else. So you're not even making that decision.
Yeah, and I think when we were doing the Everytable episode, talking about the purchasing power of restaurants, like a chain restaurant like McDonald's has a massive impact on things. And I think that is where change is going to happen. When something like the government, like to your point, or a large chain, or some one of these people like Sysco Foods that supplies all these restaurants, and they don't care. Like they might have a sustainability initiative, but I really believe that they are more focused on just the pure economics.
Yeah.
A lot of things, like I think part of that is that certification story of like, hey, I want a label on my package that says this is certified organic so that I can add that value to my customer. Because what is the point if I, as a grocery store or I, as a restaurant, can't say, hey, all our produce is certified organic or certified sustainable or vertical.
Even if it's not actually organic, right?
Right, or, which is a very mushy definition at best, right? So I think that when that starts to get added to the value chain, then you can start to see it compete outside of that price parity point. But I just don't think there is a lot of that. And everyone's so skeptical of it anyway. So I think price parity is really what's going to drive this.
Yeah. And I also think chefs can do a lot of work. I mean, like when I was a kid growing up, kale was something that was like a garnish that was put around like a charcuterie board or something. And now it's like, kale's everywhere, right? And like it's a joke now about, you know, how much we Californians love our kale.
Well, they used to say that Pizza Hut was the biggest consumer of kale in America because they would put it around the other food as decoration.
Hilarious.
But it's also nice, you know, what you're saying about like vertical farming and all these different companies that are being a part of them. And we've profiled a few of them. You know, we've done Farm Pod, which is doing like container farming, a shipping container. We've done the Netherlands. They have some futuristic farms there as well. With like Farm Pod, for example, they're actually selling it right to chefs. Right. So they're like, you can vertically farm outside of your restaurant and get, you know, greens that are not just fresh from the farmer's market, they're fresh from 10 feet away 20 minutes ago. Right. And so that's also another really interesting driver of adoption here.
Yeah, I was going to say, we had done actually another vertical farming piece, but the guy was based in England, and he was talking about how he had to be like just super cheap on everything. And he even showed us that the pens that were in his office were pens that he stole from other offices because he didn't want to literally spend any money on pens. But that's because like the VC culture in the United Kingdom is totally different, right? So he has to actually make it have economical sense from day one and build it that way. Whereas like Plenty's has tons of VC money. And at a certain point with all this stuff, in order to achieve scale, like you just have to have a lot of capital in the beginning and hope that it pays off.
Part of me also wonders though about like, so almost every city I go to, they have like locally grown gardens and like all these types of communities that are allowing people in urban settings to get back into farming, but in small scale ways. And then, but you combine like that mentality with like the large scale kitchens that you see where people can go in and like, you don't own this kitchen, but you can rent it.
Right.
Like, could you do that with vertical farming? Like, that seems like a crazy out there type of thing, but eventually the technology is going to get cheaper and like, you'll be able to have some buildings in places. And like, what happens to this locally grown idea that people clearly like to do when I, as an individual, can potentially have access to grow my own crops in a vertical farm?
Yeah.
Like, how does this scale down in the way that FarmPod does, but also how does this almost become like a WeWork of vertical farms?
I actually think it scales down further than that.
Oh, really?
Like, there's a lot of home vertical farming solutions that are coming up. Like, the kind you could put in your apartment. Like, you don't even need a house in an outdoor area. You could potentially just put these in your house, in your like one bedroom apartment.
My friend was growing plants in his closet since way before it was cool.
Right.
Which is wonderful. Legally? Illegally?
I mean, I mean, that's a big part of this too, right? Like, it was very profitable, I imagine. But the people who are growing weed, who are growing marijuana indoors, they drove this technology, all the hydroponics, all of the LED technology, all that stuff, all that drove innovation in this space underground. And that's what has made it possible for people to do this at a commercial scale. So thank your friend for a lot of things.
I'll put in a good word for you.
So to sum this all up, I guess the question is this a big deal enough that we could see really hard resetting it from scratch? Could we really rebuild? And I'm going to weigh in on this to bias the conversation, to say no. I think it's a huge deal, but I don't think we could ever hard reset our society with just vertical farming, because there are so many staple crops that just don't fit well within that. There's wheat, there's corn, like you were saying, and there's all sorts of things like that. But I do think it's gonna be a really vital part to reducing our footprint, and it's something we're gonna see more and more of, and potentially really, I think, change everyone's lifestyle if we see this in every neighborhood or every home.
Can I offer a soft challenge?
Sure.
What if we have another Dust Bowl-like situation?
That's a really good question. I think I don't see that as very likely for a couple of reasons. One, I think we've moved on from that form of really harsh tilling and things like that. There's a lot of great no-till farming is huge in the Midwest. So I don't see that as very likely, but I do think we need to get more efficient at growing better kinds of produce. I think the hard reset here, not to get too political, is just farm subsidies of like, should we just be subsidizing corn to the extent that we do? Should we look at subsidizing things then with more diversity? I think that was really where the hard reset is. Again, thinking about scale and money. But I think the technology, I think, will make a huge impact when it starts to become more atomized, more distributed, and just creates better options for people in their marketplace.
Yeah, I think also the thing that will change are consumers' tastes. Like literally their taste buds, right? Like once you have ever done anything like Whole 30 or something, you just like cut out salt or cut out sugar, you kind of reset that.
Then what is this?
So you should try it, you know, because then like the moment that you have something sweet after 30 days of not having sugar, any added sugar, like your tongue is just in a totally different place, right? And you're seeing that happen more and more. And I think that what could happen is just like we did the story on Every Table, which is going into food deserts and doing like sweet green type bowls and salads. And as those become more and more popular, like people's tastes change, like the things that they demand change. And I do think that that will impact the desire for something like vertical farms. That, and I think we kind of touched on it earlier, but you know, they're putting this vertical farm in Compton. And I think the idea of jobs and being able to really change where jobs get placed, especially as, you know, tech starts to, you know, take out jobs in other sectors, this is a really interesting place for there to be a lot of employment opportunities.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I definitely agree with you that it's never going to do all plants for sure. One thing, I guess there's two areas where I do think it's sort of like a hard reset. One is locally in places like California where you have water issues, where you could see it potentially changing just how agriculture exists in the state.
Right.
And the other thing is in outer space, you know?
Yeah.
So like the first shot in the video, right, is like, this is a farm on Mars. And actually a lot of our audience sort of glommed onto that and was talking about like, oh, you know, we could do this on a moon base. We could do this, you know, in a space station or something like that. So when we talk about, you know, if that is actually going to happen, you know, this could be potentially a piece of that. And that would certainly, I think, be a hard reset from where we are today.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a thought experiment we do a lot when we were talking about these shows. It's just like, how would this change how we would build a Mars base? Mm-hmm. And that was where we came up with that line for the opening of it. But and it's something we ask a lot about these things, where it's like, could you use this on Mars? Mm-hmm. Or you could on the moon or whatever. And I think that, yeah, absolutely. And I don't think we would be growing a lot of wheat or corn on Mars. I think, you know, this it's well suited to that.
Yeah, 100%.
How about you, Rob?
I think we're all right in saying that it's not going to 100% change everything. But I think the impact that this type of growing will have on food, the upside of that change is sort of hard to pin down. Mm-hmm. Because it depends on so many people just making decisions just based off of what they want to prioritize. Mm-hmm. And it's if you think about some of like the pressures that are on big purchasers in order to meet sustainability goals.
Right.
Like as we're going to see more of the impacts of climate change, I think the pressures for people to actually think about sustainability as it comes to food is going to increase. And so like, is there just going to be social pressure on some of these people in order to get them to change their behaviors? And I think that's the X factor here. I brought up the Dust Bowl thing just as like an example of, you know, we're in this moment now where it feels like black swan events are just coming out of nowhere everywhere, right? Like the last 3 years, it's just been black swan event after black swan event.
Yeah, Europe's on fire right now.
Yeah, and who's to say that there's not some type of parasite or some type of other thing that just makes
Rob, do you know something about this? Listen, I don't know, you're making me a little worried.
I was talking to Bill Gates a little bit earlier. No,
in about 4 seconds, Rob is going to plug an at-home supply of food that you can store in your basement.
You should have your bucket, just be prepared. But like, who's to say where the threats come from,
right,
where this becomes a lot more of a viable option and for us to do at scale than it was before. So those are the only caveats, but like, you know, everything else being equal, like, yeah, I don't think we're going to change too much too quickly.
But here, it's not even black swan events. I mean, it's just the trends.
Like, right.
Anytime, you know, I lived in the Bay Area for 10 years, and like anytime you really go to like Sonoma or you're asking about like the grapes in the vineyards, it's all posh and very lush. But you talk to like an actual farmer, they're like, yeah, we're losing money every year. Mm. Like the crop was way too hot, or it rained for 3 days straight, everything flooded out. Like we didn't make our yield. And that's just only going to increase.
Right.
And so I think the question is like, you know, can you vertically farm grapes? And do you, you know, as a consumer, do you really care at a certain point if like the wine is good, you know, and how does that scale to everything else?
I'm also interested how these things intersect with like genetically modified foods. Like, could you genetically modify an apple so it doesn't have to grow on a tree? And like, then could you put that in a vertical farm? And so that would be interesting to see, if people are going to try and do that. Mm-hmm. And then maybe that changes some of the scale equation.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't sound crazy. I mean, it's not crazy because we already genetically modify food to fit the existing food supply chain.
Yeah.
You know, like, and we mentioned that in the episode where tomatoes are literally being engineered to be more durable so they can endure being trucked across 3 states mm-hmm. to be sold in another marketplace. And I cut you off, Toby. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I was just saying it was interesting because they're picking like specific wavelengths of light to maximize freshness and different flavors. Mm-hmm. But when you do that with genetic modification sort of hand in hand, it's interesting to think what possibilities could be there.
Yeah, well, this also goes back to the taste thing. So Brandon Stewart, our CSO, he often says like, why can't we make salad taste like cake? Because then I would eat a lot more salad. And like, if you could actually do that through I don't even know how you would do something like that, but like, if you could make it sweeter or like lean into the taste buds of things that people like and enjoy, like, would that change enough consumer
I would be
behavior?
There ricing cauliflower all the time.
Oh, 100%. So, anyway.
I mean, they can't even make keto cake taste like cake.
Yeah, it's amazing how hard it is to make cake taste like cake when you take out, you know, gluten.
Right.
Stuff like that. So let's talk about the downsides of vertical farming, because I do think one of the things we addressed in there is if you did restart this from scratch, there would be huge disruption to the job market. Like you said, we're talking about this sort of Americana image of farming would be sort of changed irreparably. And there's definitely a job side of this, but I'm curious, what are some of the other downsides that you guys, that pop into your heads as you watch the video or think about it?
I think it really is just the job side of this. I mean, we talk about the cost of electricity that's going into this, but with some of our other hard reset episodes, that problem doesn't seem to be something that is going to be long-term, right? That if you can get enough solar power, if you can use renewables enough, like the cost of electricity becomes something that you don't really have to think about nearly as much. So it, you know, you drive along the five and you see all the different farmers that are out there, right? You see all the signs that are already talking about just how difficult it is for people to get the water that they need in order to like raise those different crops. Like I think all those people become severely impacted, but they've been getting impacted for the last 100 years when most of us were farming too, right?
Right.
Those are two questions that have actually come up a lot in the comments. Yeah. So one is the electric thing, because people are very skeptical of greenwashing always. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're saying like you have like plants which have traditionally been solar powered, and all of a sudden like you're putting them indoors and then using artificial lighting and then trying to grow them. And like, is that, I don't know where that power is coming from. It could be coming from fossil fuels. Is this a really more efficient way to grow things? Or is it just, you know, pushing the emissions and the environmental impact into some place you don't see it?
Yeah.
So we get a lot of those questions. And then we also get the questions about the jobs. Both, you know, traditionally, like whenever we do a new technology, there's always like, oh, this is going to put someone else out of a job, which is...
They took our jobs!
yeah. You know, and it's happened throughout history. We've covered it through, you know, telephone operators to, you know, horse mail carriers to whatever.
Yeah.
But at the same time, one interesting thing that came up specifically with this episode was about its impact on, you know, countries where people do a lot of subsistence farming.
Oh, right.
So we have one model of farming in America, which is, you know, the traditional image, and then also increasingly like mechanized, industrialized farms. But then you have a lot of places in the world where it's just, you know, families and towns and stuff like that that are farming. And are they a prospective place that would adopt this? How would it affect them, kind of a thing? Which I thought was pretty interesting. I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The electricity one and the fossil fuel thing is interesting too, just because I think part of the reason why traditional agriculture is so like bad from a greenhouse gas perspective is because it has to move around so much. So like, I don't know if on net, like having these local vertical farm centers where you like cut down on the transportation cost offsets the fact that you're no longer using the sun to like grow your food. Maybe that does offset in some type of way. So I don't know how to necessarily gauge the negative impact of the electricity stuff without like that full calculation. The jobs one is interesting because I don't think about necessarily the jobs of, I think about like the migrant impact actually. And so like what happened, because most of the workers who are working in American farms, particularly, they're migrant workers, right? And they're seasonal. So how does that change that dynamic? And I don't know if it's a negative or positive, but there's certainly going to be groups of people who might not be able to send money back home.
Right.
And that is a huge way that a lot of people survive in countries south of our border. And like, what does that do?
Yeah.
And like, could they get jobs in this place? I don't know about that. Like, I don't think a lot of VC backed companies are going to be bringing on a lot of like undocumented workers.
Right.
Right. So that seems tough. And to your point about subsistence farming, it is interesting to think about that from both from just like, would these folks adopt it? And also, would this be something forced upon them? Mm-hmm. You got this a little bit with GMO crops where the folks were like, we don't want those seeds. And it's like, well, this is all you got. And so if this gets like through the nonprofit industrial complex, if this gets like foisted upon like countries who, and people in those countries who don't necessarily want it, like that's not a good thing.
Right.
Like people have to agree to want this type of thing and to change their way of life. Or else, it just have a lot of negative impacts.
Yeah. Well, and also like subsistence farming in a lot of these places is done because they don't have an upfront capital to invest in the mechanization
that totally.
American farming has been able, and other industrialized nations have been able to invest in. And this falls well within that. These are not cheap facilities. These are, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to build. And so it seems unlikely that this would be spontaneous there. This is going to require more industrialization in these places. The jobs thing is really interesting because one of the things they tout at Plenty is they're creating better jobs, and they're not seasonal, they're year-round, and they're higher paying because you have to have more technical expertise. But to your point, that means a whole different kind of person is going to be competing for those jobs. And like, it's not going to, if you're the person who lives in that city legally and you're the person who's visiting and has a, you know, temporary work permit, you're going to have a harder time getting that job. And so, yeah. And I'm curious how that stacks up in historical sense with things like, you know, like Detroit, where we stopped making all these cars in America. But there's this huge workforce that then has to be kind of put into creative fields and other things. What happens when that workforce is temporary, is visiting from another place? And do we have the same incentive to create new jobs and new industries to support them as we do after manufacturing left the United States to the extent that it did? And that's just an open question. I don't think that we have any real sense of what that looks like.
Yeah, and manufacturing is very much coming back.
Well, that's true.
Too, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think one of the conceits of the show is that we were really going to be very American, like focusing on this, because there are so many different places in the world that all.
Why would we need to change things here? I don't understand. Yeah.
Well, also, it's just so hard for us to be able to speak with any level of credibility about, you know, broad generalizations for you know, 200 countries. And also, I think thinking about this from like just a decade in the future, right? Like, we have no idea the ripple effects that are going to happen. But I do think it's pretty safe to assume that vertical farms are only going to be in wealthy countries, really only in urban environments for that next 10 years.
Right.
Right. And so those impacts, I think, in other places aren't going to be felt quite as much. But one thing you actually reminded me of is you should say the Chavez story. Remember about like farming and... Do you want to get into
that? Yeah, the short-handled hoe.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah.
But we were talking about just like how like those jobs, a lot of times these jobs are not like the best.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to say, hey, these are jobs no one wants. But because, well, you don't want them. Someone wants them. But there are also jobs that are objectively bad jobs. And a good example of that is things like the short-handled hoe, where people were given a short tool because it was more effective to have them bend over to do the hoeing in a field. But it was also terrible for their bodies and just backbreaking labors. It's really like borders on, it might actually be a human rights issue more than a labor or an, you know, technology issue. That so the short-handled hoe essentially, I believe, is banned for widespread use in California. And that was part of the, that was at my to my understanding, that was part of the one of the reforms that was championed by Cesar Chavez, and when he was working for farm workers' rights in California. And so I think it's easy to say, hey, these are just bad jobs, or these are just jobs no one wants, but you have to really dive in. Some of these are good jobs that we're just not paying people enough for. Some of them are objectively terrible jobs that will destroy your body. And we ought to really be looking closer at that and having a little bit more nuance in how we discuss whether these jobs are good or bad for people.
Well, I think one of the things that you pick up from the Plenty video when you watch it for the 12th time, as you as you have to, is that it's not just the plants that are vertical. It's also the people that are vertical, right? And farming usually is back-breaking work. Like a lot of the, you know, strawberries, like all these things are really grown on the ground. And if you want to get that thing, you have to like bend over and get it. Yeah. And just like, how does that just change basic physiology if you can stand, walk around all day? And a lot of these people aren't even really even touching the plants themselves, which is super interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, yeah, to your point, when you look at that video of the plant, you just see people walking around, standing up, and no one's, it makes sense. They've designed the farm around human physiology instead of contorting human physiology and poses and postures to meet the landscape, which is awful for you. Just awful.
It's one of the things that's so hard to like predict out, you know, is like the ripple effects, like you're talking about. Like, you know, some people have subsistence farming jobs and they hate them and it's a brutal way to live and they would love a better option. Some people, you know, are that's their way of life and there isn't an alternative. And it's just so hard to deal with this from, you know, behind a desk and thinking about like, okay, well, if A happens, then B happens, then C's going to happen, then D's going to happen. In some cases, one of the ways today is so exciting is because you have these technologies that are just being done in a decentralized manner by different actors. And then, you know, tomorrow in 5-10 years, we're doing something and then we have to react to it and find new solutions to the problems that it creates. But it's part of a broader movement pushing us forward.
Yeah. All right. So, Toby, I'm curious, what was the overall audience response to this when you were reading through the comments? I would love to hear what the audience thought of this episode.
So the audience is actually really positive about this episode, which is always...
Taylor was worried.
It's always nice to hear, you know, as a comment moderator, you know, sometimes you don't have to look very far to see negative comments. But in this case, you know, not most of them weren't mean or anything. There were a few good questions. People excited about this being the future of, you know, yeah, agriculture in various ways. And people excited to work in the field. A lot of people who are like, oh, I'm working on something like this, or I saw this other thing that was really cool in this line. So, you know, that's always what I love to see. It's just like, kind of like organic excitement.
Well, I'm curious.
Like, how would you hate on this though? That's my question is like, the future is delicious. You know, it's like that, like that's really what we're talking about.
Yeah. I'm curious. What was there like for people who weren't positive? Like what was the core argument or beef they had with it?
This is the Great Reset. So hard reset, great reset, very similar. Great reset.
They figured us out.
We should do an episode on.
We probably shouldn't have named ourselves.
I don't know.
Quite so close to the secret cabal that we were actually.
We were this close to getting away with it, and then we picked the wrong title.
Hadn't been for you, lousy kids.
So there's that like conspiracy, like oh, you're getting away from the Earth, and it's unnatural. You know, that sort of plays in. You have a bit of this is just too expensive. It's not going to work. You have, actually, I was interested to see how many people were concerned for the plants, who were like, how do the plants feel about this? And I was like, they've been silent on the issue, you know?
Plants have nothing to say for some reason.
Yeah, but people were like, this is the Matrix for plants, you know? This is, this is unholy and repent, you know, all kinds of things like that, so.
Oh, interesting. I mean, if you look at agriculture 100 years ago, it's just totally different, right? Mm-hmm. The amount of like pesticides and technology that is going into this stuff and has been going into it for a while is it's crazy, right?
And also, let's be honest, by definition, there's nothing natural about agriculture.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
There are a lot of people who are confused about that, who are like, but if they're not growing in the soil, they won't have the natural ecosystem and stuff like that. I'm like, it's not a natural ecosystem when you get corn from the grocery store.
Yeah, I mean, I think Nate actually makes a point in the episode that it's like, we actually changed the entire world in order to satisfy our needs here.
Yeah, yeah, we also changed the plants. Like, if you look at what corn looked like prior to like us really making it a crop, it looked way different.
Very
different. So did watermelon, like... All crops are genetically modified. We just did it the hard way. Mm-hmm. Everything about our food process is, if you want to call it unnatural, it's certainly not wild, right? You don't see these crops like appear in nature in these ways.
No.
So yeah, I think it's a weird criticism that people have, but people also have weird like notions of natural versus unnatural. They like put values in there that don't necessarily make sense from a conceptual level.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think one of the things that we haven't talked about that's really interesting is biodiversity,
right?
Just the number, you talked about corn, just the number of different kinds of corn. And the only time you see corn that is not like sweet and yellow is like when it's on your table at Thanksgiving and it's like purple or, you know, a different color. But like we've chosen just as a species, like a very select few things to actually grow. And I think one of the things that's actually really exciting about this is can vertical farms bring a lot of diversity to just the kinds of things that we're growing, right? So maybe it's not corn or wheat, but it's 100 different kinds of strawberries.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's also interesting when you think about it, because it's like, how many times have we hard reset agriculture throughout human history? You know, I mean, first, even just going to agriculture from being hunter gatherers, that was a complete reinvention of how we got nutrients, and then selective breeding, and then all of these things. And so, you know, maybe in that context, it isn't so crazy to think that now when we have computers and automation, we should have another iteration of how we grow our food.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the biodiversity thing can't be overstressed, that, you know, we didn't evolve to eat just cereal crops and red meat. We evolved to eat, you know, fruits, vegetables, nuts, bugs, whatever animals we could find. Like we were very much an omnivore by design. And it's sort of weird that we're like, well, I think I'm going to have pasta tonight, tomorrow, the next day. And like, just like lots
why
and lots
of. Why are you telling about my business?
I love pasta. You make great pasta. But no, we really are so tied into just a few staple crops now. And that's not evolutionarily appropriate for us. We want to have a diversity, and being able to do so in a smaller footprint, I think, is just more, it's not more natural, but it is more human-centered. Were there any other interesting comments or anything like that that came up specifically that you recall from this one that we should respond to directly, or were there anything like, you know, call outs that they think we got stuff wrong or anything like that that you can think of?
I think we covered most of them. I guess, you know, the specific thing that came up a lot was the electric thing, and how is it clean overall and how much does it cost?
Yeah. I think that's a super valid concern.
Totally.
Because if you're covering up more ground for solar panels just to grow crops indoors, then what's the point? Yeah. So we did look into this a little bit, and you do need to have solar panels on the roof of these things for them to really start to become sustainable, and then some. You need to have more than just the footprint of the store. But you can do that in a way that is economically and ecologically sustainable. What I find a little suspicious is when people say, hey, we're just going to buy green power. Mm-hmm. I think that gets into that greenwashing thing where it's like, well, if you're just buying green power, then someone else is just buying, you're making more people buy coal. So I think that what I do think is that the Plenty folks seem to be pretty focused on that. Most of the other vertical farms we've talked to have been focused on creating their own power and also doing building solar cells in a way that actually is restorative, where it can actually help restore land as opposed to use it up.
I think that's a really underappreciated point, is that when we do things more densely, you know, whether it's, you know, living or farming, we open up so much landscape that can be rewilded, which is another big movement that's happening. You know, it can be restored to more natural space than currently we have it as farms or whatnot. One other thing that I was personally curious about was, so you tasted the food, and it was really interesting how they had, like, you know, different types of light to make different textures and stuff like that. What was it like to actually experience?
It's tasty greens. Like I'm not going to say like, man, this was mind-blowingly good, because at the end of the day, it's kale.
Yeah.
It was tasty. Like it was some of the best kale I've ever had, for sure. So it is a premium price product, and it is a premium flavor. Like it tastes really good. So I was trying to be very unbiased. I got their whole product line that I could buy in the area at the time and tried everything, and all of it was great. Nothing was like, I'm not a huge fan of just eating green plant leaves, but
yeah. What's your line?
I don't eat green food.
No, that kale is what food eats.
Yeah, kale is the food for my food. Yeah, that's, but no, it's, I am trying to eat more plants and eat more like.
Nick only eats vegans.
Exactly. Oh, you're a meat eater? I'm not. I'm trying to go more organic. I'm trying to be more conscious about the choices I make, but I've never been like huge into salads and kale and things like that, but these are tasty. And I think, like the kale pesto that I made that a lot for a long time because it is a really good good pesto. But of course, you're mixing in Parmesan cheese and olive oil and pine nuts and things. So how much of the flavor is actually from the greens and how much is that? But is it as good as basil pesto? In my mind, yeah, it was. Mm-hmm. So I was pretty impressed with it.
Cool.
So worth the money, I would say so.
And it was all greens in the factory that you saw? They didn't have fruit on
correct.
It?
Correct. I think that as of the time we aired the episode, and I believe still, I don't think they have anything besides those leafy greens that they sell. But I know they are working on tomatoes and strawberries and things like that. Was there anything in this episode that you wish we'd spent more time on or that you wish we'd been able to dive into more?
I think the light technology and how they're choosing the wavelengths and just getting into the whole science behind how they're figuring that out.
Right.
I mean, that seems like a whole new field of science to really perfect that. I went to school with a kid whose father had invented McDonald's ketchup.
Like invented it?
Like he came up with like the taste of McDonald's ketchup. I'm like, that was like mind blowing because it's like, the best ketchup. So I think about...
Hot take.
You're right.
Yeah, right? We can edit this later if you feel like you need to change your mind about that. Really? You think McDonald's is the best ketchup?
I mean, it's good, but it's always paired with McDonald's fries, which are clearly...
Well...
Right. It's a little biased.
Okay.
Whatever. You don't like... Okay.
I like McDonald's fries.
Okay. Isn't it just Heinz? I didn't realize... I thought they used Heinz.
No.
No, they have their
own. I always thought it was Heinz too, yeah.
No, it's not. They have their own ketchup. Yeah. So the food science of this whole thing, right? And how they're picking the wavelengths, I think is super interesting.
Yeah.
We could spend more time on that.
Yeah, and it's flavor, but it's also sustainability, right? Because like if you're broadcasting on all the spectrums, like the lights we're using here have like they cover the whole spectrum from, you know, red all the way up to blue. But if you only need like a little bit of a spike of this wavelength and this wavelength, you can save a lot of power. You can turn down the parts of the LED and use less electricity. And that's a big part of not just the flavor, but also just the power savings of this that you don't. And when you go to most vertical farms, they aren't bright white inside, actually. They're usually like pink or magenta feeling. Because it's just a certain part of the spectrum that the plants really respond to.
Yeah, and I think the other thing on the other side is the water aspect of things.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they said that 99% of the water is recycled.
Right.
And so just how they do all of that recycling and how they've built the facilities in order to accommodate that. And I'm sure they're trying to get to 100%.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think water efficiency is the real savings. And it's like, does that offset whatever, you know, electricity usage? Because, you know, right now we're in the middle of a drought. We can throw up a lot of solar panels. It's hard to throw up rain clouds. And so I think right now that to me seems like the on balance, really just pretty a huge reward for what you get out of it.
I mean, that's what we say the hard reset really is that you need sunlight and rain in order to grow food.
Right.
It's like, maybe not.
Maybe not. So Rob, I'm curious from your perspective, is there anything that you think we didn't cover well in this episode or other concerns that you think our audience have?
I do think in general, a love for us to always like explain more how a thing works. Mm-hmm. And with this one, the thing that comes to mind, you know, we've been talking about electricity, just like how much electricity does one facility use?
Right.
Right. Like, can we put a number on that? Or if we explain the water stuff a little bit more deeply in terms of just how do they recycle the water? Where does that come from? And all of those types of things. But at the same time, we were just starting that show.
Yeah.
It was the middle of the pandemic. And I believe we actually didn't get to go to plenty.
Correct. Yeah. All the footage of the inside of their facility they provided for us. Unfortunately, we didn't get to go and film in there because of the pandemic and because of it's a food safe facility. They're very careful about who they let in.
Yeah. Nick and I have been filming in so many of these like safe environments, whether it be like a surgical robotic place or something. So we have this collection of pictures over the year and different types of PPE. But this one was sad that we didn't get to go. But we did get a camera guy into the plant in Wyoming.
I think it does explain though why you don't go into depth as much, right? Because there's like, if you could go to their big facility and you could talk to a person who does the water stuff, that might be a more natural way to include that versus like, oh, you're going to have to do this with exposition and voiceover, and then that's animation that we get. Like, there's a lot of choices that get involved there.
Yeah, I mean, the thing for part two, because I think that's kind of what we're talking about. part two on the episode that I think is really interesting is the Compton facility.
Right.
And why I find that particularly interesting is that some of the first farmers markets in the United States were in Watts, which is right next to Compton. Right. And the whole notion of a farmers market was to bring fresh fruits and vegetables to the community, to people that were lower income that needed those nutrients. And now a farmer's market is like so hoity-toity and it's like more expensive than going into the grocery store. So I think it's really interesting to go back into Compton, be providing jobs, be having a facility that's like this right there. And I'm really curious as to how the community has reacted to Plenty being there.
Yeah. So the last thing we should probably talk about is what's happened since. And I don't know that I have any specific updates to Plenty that are worth bringing up, but I think in general we can safely say this is a trend that is picking up more and more. Like you were saying earlier, there's just a lot more out there.
Yeah, I mean, we've done, I think, at Freethink now, a half dozen episodes on different kinds of vertical farms, whereas before this, like, I don't think I had even read about vertical farms before.
Right.
And I think you're just seeing more mentions of it in New York Times. I mean, like, you know, you go into Whole Foods up in the Bay, and, like, you're seeing those products there. So people want delicious stuff.
Yeah, it's certainly a trendy piece of technology, both from a media coverage standpoint and also just you're seeing it more.
Right.
Right.
I think the other thing that's really interesting is since we made this episode, the economy, you know, crashed.
like a couple times.
Yeah. And so, you know, so much about, you know, VC money and what's, you know, fun and plenty and other vertical farms like it is the idea of growth.
Right.
Right. And now we're in an economy where it's not about growth. It's about, you know, staying in business and profitability. And so I wonder how that changes the aspect of things.
Well, yeah. Since the crypto bubble burst, I don't think they were going to see a plenty coin soon. So
yeah. Yeah. I haven't heard anyone talk about NFTs in 3 months and I'm really enjoying that.
Thank God.
Each coin is pegged to a piece of lettuce.
Yeah. So the other thing that I think is important to talk about is how people can get involved. You know, this is something you can do at home. And I think that's really interesting. And you were saying in the comments, people had talked about that as well, that like they're involved in doing similar sorts of things.
Yeah. That was really cool to see, like people who are working at other companies doing this or who are studying it. And generally sentiment wise, you definitely see a big divide. And I think it helps have a positive reception when it's something that's actually out in the marketplace, that it's not vaporware, you know, because otherwise there's always the, well, is this, you know, just all hype kind of a thing. But you can actually taste it. So
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
And one of the other companies we had done some research into for a different show is someone who's making a bespoke like home vertical garden. Mm-hmm. I've seen two other similar types of products that are essentially automated vertical farms for houses. And I think that, I think we're going to see more and more of this. I was very tempted to get a farm bot during the pandemic because I was like, I don't know if the grocery store will have food.
Yeah. I mean, gardening is such a hobby and DIY stuff is such a big thing now, especially that it makes sense. Like if you could build a little automated vertical farm in your garage or whatever, that's like super cool, super fun. Mm-hmm.
The biggest way, like if thinking about involvement or people want to participate, try the food, yeah. Right? Like this is something you can actually purchase. Go try it and see if you like it. And if you don't like it, tell us in the comments. Like there's tons, and if you do like it, tell us in the comments as well. You know, we talk about such future forward technology on our shows on Freethink so much, and specifically in Hard Reset, they're like not really accessible. So to right. Toby's point, the fact that this is something you can literally go into the grocery store and buy, and it is still part of this like big expansive version of the future or vision of the future, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And so that's like probably the lowest barrier to entry that I can think of for any type of technology that we have covered on yeah. the channel.
You can't do an at-home trial of a particle accelerator.
Michio Kaku did when he was a little kid.
Well, that
was
of course he did. We're not all Michio Kaku.
That's fair.
The other thing that's worth mentioning is, like you were talking about, Compton, they've been building this facility, doing a follow-up. I'm curious if the audience wants to see that. So if the audience, if y'all at home are watching this and you want to hear more about that, please do comment, like, subscribe, send us cash, whatever it takes. We'd love to go and do a follow-up because this is a story that we're really interested in. These are companies that we pick because we think people are in it, but they're also things we're excited about. So there's a lot of enthusiasm. We just want to make sure that the audience is also enthusiastic about it. So let us know if you wanted us to do a follow-up on that. That's the sort of thing that we would definitely be down to do and see what Plenty's up to down in Compton. So I guess the last thing to cover is what were the meanest comments?
Well, there was saying that we're trying to destroy civilization through the, you know, Great Reset.
Checks.
There is repent, you sinners. Jesus is coming.
Mm. And he likes affordable produce.
No one liked that comment, though. So, you know, that's still, you know, keep that in perspective. You know, it was a generally positive reception. It also helped this one, the first one, we didn't release in full on Facebook, which is just an evergreen source of mean comments. So we that may have to do a part two where we post it.
Definitely release the next one on Facebook so we can tap into the real dark vitriol that's waiting for us out there. I hope you guys enjoyed this first episode of our podcast, and we're looking forward to doing more because we're going to do another one in about 30 seconds.